This is Trauma and Recovery, a Cambodian Refugee Experience, a half-hour radio documentary written and produced by Karen Brown. Consulting producer was Laurie Block.
My mom loves farming and she's kind of passed it down to me, so I like to farm now and then, but I don't like to do it every day because it's so tedious and doesn't give me much time to have fun and study.
Sopeep Chun is 19. He lives in Amherst, Massachusetts, and attends Holyoke Community College. Born in a Thai refugee camp, he came here as a two-year-old. For most of his life, he's worked with the Khmer Growers, a Cambodian farming cooperative in this large emigre community. Sopeep explained to me what they grow.
A variety of Asian vegetables. An eggplant we call throp. We grew watergrass. It's our most popular produce. Bell peppers, jalapenos.
The Khmer Growers sell their produce at farmers markets, mostly to gourmet restaurants and to other Asians. Some of the profits are sent back to Cambodia to rebuild temples and schools. But the act of growing food serves another purpose. These Cambodians were uprooted as refugees for years. Farming helps ground them.
I can remember doing this in the early 90s when my mom started in the back of an apartment complex. We started off with seeds from Cambodia.
The town of Amherst gave the growers their own field, and it's become a place where the different generations can process the past and prepare for the future.
Well, it gives me a chance to talk to some of my elders, because at home we usually speak English to each other, and we don't have that certain connection that we do here. When we're here, they're always trying to teach me something, or they're always talking about how it was back in Cambodia.
I like it because we usually do in my country. And I still like to do it, so I want to do it to remind, you know, who I am.
Sopeep's sister, Mao Dung, is 20 years older than him and remembers Cambodia vividly. She lived through the U.S. bombing of her country during the Vietnam War and Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge regime.
When I grow up, I never go to school, you know, or have a better life, because when I grow up, it's bad time, you know, like Pol Pot running around, scary times.
The traditional agrarian society of Cambodia was destroyed by the Khmer Rouge, who forced the majority of the population to work in labor camps, now known as the killing fields. An estimated 2 million Cambodians died in 4 years. For Mao, farming transports her to a time before the bloodshed and to a life beyond it. Like most Cambodians, she's a Buddhist and believes in reincarnation.
We do the job like this from our heart. We wishing when we're doing to get the bad thing, better thing to come up to us. You know, we been saying, oh, maybe I do help some people. Maybe in my next life, somebody help me back.
Mao came to Amherst from Thailand, where thousands of refugees fled after the Vietnamese overthrew the Khmer Rouge. Refugees often stayed on the border for years, negotiating a difficult immigration process and waiting for a sponsor in a new country. In Amherst, volunteers from Protestant churches took on that role. Lisa Rao.
Emmanuel Lutheran was the first church in town that sponsored a Cambodian family. And it wasn't too long before we had all kinds of committees set up to do everything, the finding shelter and food and all that kind of thing.
So Van Dung was one of the first to arrive in Western Massachusetts.
I mean, I was struggling in Pittsville, not having any interpreter services, not speaking English myself, and my family, no one speaking any English.
Although, you know, there's a lot of overjoys, a lot of, we are here, we are free, we are in the land opportunities, but there is so little that we had to deal with.
Sam Kankun was a teenager when he arrived.
The language is totally different. The culture is completely different. And there is no existing community to go to, you know, for help.
The sponsors shuttled refugees to doctor's appointments and supermarkets. They helped fill out immigration and food stamp applications. The refugees' previous lives rarely came up. Lisa Rowell.
I wasn't very tuned in on the whole situation, but we knew things weren't good. And when they came here, they started telling us about the horrors that had happened. And I think even their grim stories didn't really register that much. We felt sorry for them, but we hadn't lived it.
But there were signs that whatever people had been through remained with them.
One of the things I remember is that they really hoarded food, and they just filled their kitchen unbelievably with food, not realizing you could go out tomorrow and just buy some more of anything.
They weren't even leaving their homes. They were so afraid.
Psychiatric nurse Margarita Rachitsky.
They weren't using banks. They had their money and their jewelry under their mattresses. They were totally overwhelmed with supermarkets. So we started with the basics. How do you clean your house? How do you use the bank? And it was during other activities that the trauma story started to be told.
I first learned about the Khmer Rouge as a college student in the 1980s from the movie The Killing Fields, but it wasn't until a close friend was diagnosed with clinical depression that I began thinking about what sends a person into despair and how they get out of it. Western medicine, with all its resources and technology, can only do so much to alleviate suffering. What could the mental health field offer people who survived war, starvation, or torture when there's no common cultural point of reference? What if you're a Muslim who speaks Pashtun, or you're a Buddhist and your language is Khmer?
There were scenes of wild jubilation in Phnom Penh today as the war in Cambodia came to an end after five bloody years. The victorious Khmer Rouge troops staged a victory parade. There were white flags everywhere and no bloodbath.
NBC News anchor John Chancellor in 1975 reflects how little the world knew the Khmer Rouge. For the next 4 years, there was a news blackout from Cambodia. The first Westerners to hear about life under the Pol Pot regime were relief workers on the Thai border. Nurse Mary Scully.
Back in 1979, I think the news was filled with Cambodians coming across and they were starving, and it was such a heart-wrenching situation. So I signed up and I went over to Thailand.
Scully described the scene at the refugee camps.
When people were coming in off the buses, they did not know whether they were being sent back into Cambodia, so that the anxiety levels were very high. Women who were 7-8 months pregnant were delivering babies, and the camp was in chaos. But right off the bat, it was very apparent I did not know what had happened in Cambodia.
In the years of no news, the Cambodian people had been repeatedly forced to uproot themselves, starting with the move from cities to rural labor camps. Tien V. Kuch, who now runs Khmer Health Advocates in Hartford, Connecticut, described what she saw as she was marched from her home.
So in the road, it was a thousand of people. It's very difficult to even move. And the people, their hands tied with the thread.
Thread,
yeah. And then what they say that if you broke that thread, they will kill you. And also you saw the body that was swollen alongside the road. Everybody gonna look at each other with no explanation. The slogan of the Khmer Rouge said that to keep you is no gain, to lose you is no loss. So that's always in our mind, every single minutes.
Svong Tor was a teacher forced to leave Phnom Penh.
We met some people who's very nice to us, told us to keep it quiet. If you see things, just look at it, don't do anything.
Svong left her home with her husband and two young sons. They would be separated in the labor camps. Only she and one son would survive the conditions.
The most we eat the leaf like a cow or buffalo to fill the stomach. If not, we cannot sleep. When we go to the toilet, no toilet, like he just go outside where we could find the place. But the stool is green like a leaf.
And on my mother's side, there's over 20 family members, you know, all her brothers, sisters, her nephews and niece, you know, disappeared.
Somkhan Khun spent 3 years in a youth mobile team.
You know, some of them were starved to death and other, you know, get, you know, sick, and million other Cambodians, you know, gone through the same, you know, hell on earth. We couldn't live there anymore and we had to make our way, escape to Thailand.
When the Khmer Rouge was ousted, thousands of survivors made the difficult journey from the labor camps to the refugee camps. Once there, they risked rape or beatings by the soldiers who were supposed to protect them. The camps were a way station. Getting out took up to a decade. A refugee had to prove to a United Nations or U.S. immigration official that they had a well-founded fear of persecution. Only then would they get permission to resettle in a safe country. Mary Scully.
Immigration days were a nightmare. By 10, 11 o'clock in Thailand, the temperatures are way up over 100 in the sun. And people would have to stand there for hours and hours, and then they would get in to see someone from immigration.
To refugees, immigration officials were just another adversary, bureaucrats behind desks judging tales of suffering to see who was worthy of a visa. They had no training in trauma and little cultural context for what Pol Pot survivors were describing. Mary Scully.
People from immigration would call them liars and would throw things. Children were asked to draw pictures of their house before the Khmer Rouge. And now you've got kids that are 7, 8 years old. They don't remember what their house was. I mean, they've just lost their parents. And they said that they were looking for the truth, but it was in a twisted, unreasonable fashion. I mean, they obviously don't know how traumatized people think.
Tien V. Cooch barely understood the paperwork. She remembers taking a test to prove that she was persecuted.
I didn't even pass the test because they would say that I was a liar and this and that. But last time when I set up my mind that I don't care whether United States take me or not, and that's the time that I was accepted.
Finding a sponsor meant navigating more political and social agendas, but refugees are resourceful. So Kane Mao's family put its hopes in the Christian missionaries.
My family wanted to get out so bad from a refugee camps, and they said that in order for you to leave the refugee camp, you had to be baptized, you had to be Christian. We went to church, we got Bibles, and took pictures. And then we sent that picture with our application and said that, yes, we became Christian, so please help us to find new home.
The refugees had no control over when or where they would be sent. So Kane Mao's family was first assigned to a sponsor in Portland, Oregon, which might as well have been Hollywood's Wild West.
So one night they saw a cowboy movie, and on the screen they said, Oregon Trail, and afterward there was just so much bloodshed. There was cowboy being dragged behind wagon, Indian attacking cowboy. So the next day, my family and I line up to ask the voluntary agency to transfer us to new states because we just came from war. We don't want to be in the middle of another war.
The refugees prepared for another anxious move, this time in the hands of international resettlement officials. So Kane, his mother, and only surviving brother left their tropical climate, boarded a plane to Boston, and arrived in the middle of a winter night.
Morning, we woke up, and all we saw was just dead trees. So my mom was just sitting on a window and crying, said that we just came from a refugee camp and now look at the trees all dead and where are we going to find food and what are we going to do? The next, you know, weeks and months, and then the trees started to grow, and that's when we realized that the tree got new lives and we got new lives along with it.
Post-traumatic stress disorder is a new name for an old problem. The symptoms, nightmares, anxiety, fear of loud noises, sleeplessness, and depression, were first observed in Civil War veterans. After the Nazi Holocaust, people realized that civilians caught in war and atrocities often faced long-lasting psychological problems. The term PTSD was coined by mental health specialists to describe the problems of Vietnam veterans. But up to that point, almost all the groups studied by doctors came from a Judeo-Christian tradition. When thousands of Southeast Asians began to enter the U.S., the challenges for the refugees and the mental health workers were much different. Jim Lavelle remembers arriving at a Boston community clinic as a young social worker.
The primary care team there was very glad to see us because they were hearing the same untellable stories that we had been hearing. They had their hands full just with the medical problems that these folks had.
Lavelle and psychiatrist Richard Malika began documenting the effects of trauma and torture on Southeast Asian refugees. They found higher rates of depression, anxiety, alcohol abuse, gambling, and even car accidents. But it would be years before state or federal policy was in place to provide mental health services for refugees.
policymakers used to go with the myth that you could just stretch people beyond belief, maybe 4 years during Pol Pot in Cambodia and another 10 years on the border, and then just send them home, and that they would snap back and they'd just be normal, productive citizens. But they're not. The depression stays with them. There's a lot of growing evidence that there seems to be a relationship between depression and mortality.
When you're walking out of the killing field, you feel like there's still the suction power pulling you back in.
So Van Dung is a therapist in Lowell, Massachusetts, home to the country's second largest Cambodian population.
You try so hard to go forward. And then when they come to this country, jobs, other opportunity is here, and they're all like struggling with it and not dealing with the past at all.
These people have difficulty in assimilating into the mainstream, you know, society.
Sam Khan Koon runs Lowell's Cambodian Mutual Assistance Association.
They are not able to carry their job because they still have, you know, the nightmares, and so any loud noise, including the siren from the ambulance or any banging noise, it really freaks them out.
Like we have an expression, this kind of story we take with us when we die, when we reborn, the story is still there, never go away.
In psychiatry, the trauma story refers to an individual's specific experiences of suffering, which can be replayed in the mind for years. Some mental health workers want to deal with the story directly. Others see it as a small part of the healing process. The key is to find a meaningful way to deal with the trauma story, and this can be complex when crossing cultural lines. Margarita Rachitsky ran a support group for Cambodian women.
One time I said in group, okay, what would make you feel 100% better or near 100%? And they said, if we could work. And I said, okay, what kind of work did you do? They said, we were farmers. So here we are in a city, right? And I said, okay, if I got a plot of land, would you want to grow things? So they said yes. And it was on this plot of land that they started then telling more of their trauma story. So now they're out there, one's digging with a pitchfork with a vengeance and laughing and smiling. And so I said to my partner, what is she talking about? And she said, oh, she's talking about how many of her children were killed in front of her. I said, oh, okay. So then another woman was really digging and laughing and everything. And I said, well, and what's going on with her? Oh, she's just talking about what she'd like to do to the Khmer Rouge if she ran into him today.
Building a partnership between Western mental health counselors and Cambodian refugees has been challenging. Initially, refugees were preoccupied with basic necessities. Mental health care was an afterthought, even when they did know where to go or how to pay for it. In Cambodia, mental health was not a medical concept. Most people consulted with village elders or Buddhist monks. And Cambodians are still wary of Western psychiatry, which is full of diagnostic labels that feel meaningless across cultures.
People do not want to be associated with mental health.
Sam Khan Koon.
People also refer to it like, you know, people are crazy.
Every time a Cambodian go to see a therapist, and then they said, okay, all you need is Prozac, all you need is something else to help you so you can sleep better, so you can eat better.
So Kane Mao is an Amherst High School counselor.
I never want to send a Cambodian to a psychologist who are not well-trained in Cambodian culture, because the Cambodian dramas is totally different than American drama.
Spilling your gut to a stranger as a therapist is not something that Cambodian people like to do. We deal with this kind of problem within our family.
Because So Van Dung is one of the few Cambodian therapists, he acts as a cultural broker between his community and Western counselors.
These people come from Cambodia, not just bringing the bag of clothes or the refugee documentation. They brought the whole culture here. Take it or leave it, you're going to have to deal with it. If you have an understanding of where these people are coming from, they could understand you, and they could use your treatment.
And that means having knowledge of and respect for Buddhist beliefs without packaging them in Western diagnoses.
For example, a Cambodian patient think that they are possessed by the spiritual past of the family. Some a family member die and their spiritual really possessed them. You know, the clinician said, do you hear any voice? Say, yeah. what did the voice say to you? Saying that I need to pay more attention to my grandparents, but they're already dead. Say, I know. And, well, that's schizophrenic, you know, the person really hearing voices. But it's not. In our culture, having in touch with your past generation, with your grandparents, through your dream or through their voice is quite normal.
That's not to say the symptoms of trauma can't be relieved by sleep medication, antidepressants, or talking through the problem. But Richard Malika says 20 years of caring for refugees has given him a respect for the things he can't treat.
You can do a lot to help the patient. You can be very therapeutic in many ways. I think that the ultimate recovery of the patient is really between the patient and their God, and their spiritual life. It has very little to do with the doctor.
This is the sound of a monk's water blessing, one of the most common rituals Cambodians take part in to relieve grief. So Van Dung frequently takes his patients to the temple.
They have to be in touch with their past. That's what the Buddhist monk said. Well, if you have not communicating with your past generation spiritual, you're not doing anything good right now. You really need to accept that that's part of you, your past. And then he would give like a water blessing.
So if I have bad dreams and I do go to the temple and ask, first talk to the monk and then ask the monk to give me water blessing.
So Cain Mao.
And the water blessing is a way, it's almost like you go to Catholic church, when you go to their little booth, what do you call that? Your confession. And you go to a monk, the same thing, you say, this is how I feel and can you help me? And in return, the Buddhist monk will talk and then will give water blessing. And the water blessing is a symbol to get rid of the bad evil from your soul so you can rest more peacefully.
In the early 1980s, the few Cambodian monks who survived the Khmer Rouge established temples in apartments, old factories, and other unconventional places. Eventually, the Amherst Cambodians raised enough money to build a temple. Sokhain Mao says the temple is helping revive their spiritual community.
In order to be Cambodian, you had to need a Buddhist. That's where our heart and soul coming from. Our language, our culture start with Buddhist. So now they have Buddhist temple, it's almost take a piece of thorn from their heart and the place that they can go worship, hang out with their friends and talk about bad things and good things, and we hope that they will live a little longer in America.
On one of my visits to the temple, an elderly monk was drinking tea on a floor cushion. His name was Maha Gosananda, and he explained the water blessing to me.
First, I tell them you just be like a water. Water become dirty, you can purify it. The mind is like a water. Can stay here. Can stay here also. Can stay in your mouth. The nature of the mind is like the nature of water.
I would later learn that Maha Gosananda is the most senior Cambodian monk in or outside the homeland. He told me depression could be set aside with mindfulness and breathing.
You are worrying because you regret the past. Let the past be the past. You worry because you crave for the future. Let the future be the future. Don't crave for it. Stay in the present. The past is already gone. Just be here now. Be here now, just breathing. Breathing in mindfully. Building out mindfully, then you are free.
Gosananda explained that Cambodian Buddhism is rooted in daily living, but its principles bridge the past and future. One principle is merit. A Buddhist earns merit by doing good deeds and refraining from bad ones. Merit can be transferred to a future life, in the form of good karma, or to the spirits of relatives who have died. But for survivors of the Khmer Rouge, the interpretation of merit can be problematic. Many believe a lack of merit in their previous life caused their suffering in this one. Tien V. Kuch.
They always, you know, blame themselves for their last life. They said that, well, because I do something bad in my last life, that's why this life, you know, I was being punished. So they accept that.
Instead of finding way to figure out, you know, what the problem with them is, sort of, well, this is me, this is what I have gone through.
Sam Khan Khun.
So I should be the one who had to deal with it alone.
Just as the Western mental health system was stretched to its limits by the Khmer Holocaust, so too was the Khmer belief system. Not even merit can sufficiently explain how the past came to be or what the future holds. So Van Dung.
I mean, when there's 2 million Cambodians die during the Holocaust and you are surviving, there's always a question, why do you survive? What did you do right and what did they do wrong?
Today, Cambodians in America are giving their new lives meaning on their own terms. They find sources of resilience in their traditions, building temples, taking part in sacred rituals, getting back to farming, and reviving celebrations. Cultural events have particular meaning to refugees who lost not only loved ones, but all that was familiar. This is why Sam Khan Khun created the annual Southeast Asian Water Festival in Lowell.
Through recreating this kind of cultural and identity, cultural environment, that we can internally, you know, just like sitting down in a meditation center, try to come up with some way to deal with this wounded heart.
Like celebrations once held on the Mekong River, thousands of Asians from around New England take part in boat races on the Merrimack River, watch traditional dance, and eat traditional food.
And then we have fried rice with the red pork, chicken wing, and also we have beef jerky like a Laotian style. We marinate overnight.
It helps, you know, people to associate with they're not completely alien or foreign to this country, and that they have the freedom to practice their belief and their religions and their cultures. And not only that, but also to share that with their family and also their neighbors and their community. For us, it's a healing process.
Some Western health workers have taken cues from the Cambodians, encouraging them to resurrect traditional dance, theater, and music. Margarita Rachitsky says these art forms can do for her patients what conventional therapy cannot.
Imagine that someone dropped a bomb here, and you survived, and all of your art museums were gone. All forms of your music just disappeared. And then, 25 years later, someone said, hey, here's the Boston Symphony. We've recreated it. You would say, wow, a piece of my past is now back again. It makes you feel happy. That's what mental health is all about.
Two million war refugees from around the world have arrived in the U.S. since the 1970s. For many, their trauma can't be fully resolved by either Western medicine or native customs. But mental health workers say they feel better prepared for them today than 20 years ago. There's a greater emphasis on early intervention and cultural sensitivity. Still, what refugees say they need the most is access to the traditional resources that support their own resilience and renew the mind and spirit.
Trauma and Recovery, a Cambodian refugee experience, was written and produced by Karen Brown at WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. Consultant producer was Laurie Block. Research and production help was provided by Alex Chambers, Sean Norton, and Bart Feller. Funding support came from the Kaiser Family Foundation. News footage from NBC News Archives. Music by Hang Pen and Celestial Harmonies.